Views and opinions expressed by the hosts are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of their employers. This podcast may not be suitable for children. Adults may find details triggering and/or offensive. Listener's discretion is advised.
Hey everyone, this is Priscilla.
And this is Norma.
And you're listening to
It's the Mystery for Me. Episode of It's a Mystery for Me.
Yeah. And Norma is the hostess with the mostest again this week. And without further ado, we're just going to go ahead and turn right to the episode because I know y'all been waiting for 2 weeks, so we ain't going to keep you waiting any longer.
Oh, yeah. I forgot.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like 2 weeks.
It doesn't.
It goes by really fast. Okay. So for today's episode, I watched an episode of a show called Justice by Any Means, and that is season 1, episode 9. I also looked at a few articles and websites like CBS News, CNN, Daily News, among others, as well as some Court of Appeals documents.
The show Justice by Any Means, what channel is that on? I don't know if I've heard of it. Maybe I have heard of it.
I found it online. I literally had to download Roku. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, Roku.
Yeah. I had to sign up for a trial.
You went the extra mile, Norma. Yeah. We appreciate you.
Yeah.
For a full list of this week's sources, go ahead and check out our website, itsthemysteryforme.com, or click the link in today's show notes.
This story takes us back to 2013 in Pontiac, Michigan. This is a case of Rosalyn Ramson. Rosalyn, who is referred to as Rhonda by her family and friends, was born on August 14th, 1980. So in 2013, she was 32 years old. Rosalyn, who I will also refer to as Rhonda the rest of this episode, was one of four siblings. It was her, Rudy, Robin, and Rochelle. Rochelle and Robin, they both make appearances on this show. Rosalyn and her family grew up in Detroit in the neighborhood of Pontiac, Michigan. And they lived in a tight-knit community where their father had lived since he was 11 years old. So they were well-known in the community. Rhonda had a relatively normal upbringing. Rhonda is described as sweet, shy, and she aspired to be a nurse, but those dreams slowed down a bit when she became a mother of three. So she had two sons, ages 6 and 12, and a 9-month-old daughter. She and her kids were living in her parents' home in Pontiac, Michigan, and at some point during her stay, she met the father of her third child, Miles, and they were in a relationship, but it didn't work out. So by 2013, Rhonda was faced with many challenges as a single mother, and it was just difficult just trying to get by despite having the support of her family. Rhonda just wanted more for herself and her kids, and she ended up going back to school, and she got a certificate as a medical assistant. So it was one step closer to her dreams of being a nurse. She had actually enrolled in college and was preparing to start in the fall. Things were looking up for Rhonda, but then things started to go left with her ex, Miles. He expressed not wanting to be in their daughter's life, and he basically told Rhonda, "If you want something from me, take it to court. I'll pay child support." But he didn't want anything to do with Rhonda or their daughter.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
That's sad.
So
for the daughter specifically.
Yeah, no, I would.
Things don't work out sometimes with people, but.
It's a 9-month-old. She might be going through postpartum. Right. It's just very stressful.
Yeah.
So that wasn't easy. And then when Memorial Day weekend of 2013 came around, it was a perfect opportunity for her to unwind and just relax with her family and friends. So on Saturday, May 25th, 2013, Rhonda was hanging out with friends and her family, like her sister, Robin, and their mother. And then at around 2 a.m., Miles calls Rhonda. Miles tells her that he has diaper money for the baby and that if she wanted it from him, she needed to come get it from him right now.
At 2 a.m.?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-uh.
So apparently Miles just got off of work and he said that he would be pretty busy for the rest of the week. So this was her only opportunity.
Wait a minute. It's 2013. Zelle doesn't exist yet?
I actually wrote that down in my notes.
According to Google, Zelle started in June of 2017. But we know Black people used Cash App.
Black people love Cash App. PayPal.
True. Cash App was released in October of 2013. So PayPal had been around since way before. PayPal had actually been around since December of 1998. Yeah. So there were options. Venmo started in 2009 and is owned by PayPal since 2013.
Oh my goodness.
Just so random. Yeah. Learning so much, y'all.
I don't know what the circumstances were, if he just had it in cash. I don't know if he had a bank account that was...
2013 was still like a cash time.
Yeah.
You know, it really was, so...
Or, you know, you could go to the supermarket and almost like wiring money.
Oh,
I can't think
of... I know what you're talking about. Western Union?
Yeah, Western Union.
I feel like people don't really use that unless it's like it's going really far.
Right. So, I mean, I feel like Mom would Western Union me sometimes when I was in college.
You were far away. You were two hours away. How far is this ninja?
About a mile.
Okay. Like, so. Don't tell me she left the house to get the diaper money at 2 a.m.
Well, she did. And her family basically told her to don't even bother.
Right.
But to Rhonda, it wasn't so much about the money. It was just the principle of the fact that he needed to step up and be a father to their daughter. And she felt that he wasn't really doing that. He wasn't really present in their daughter's life.
Yeah, but I guess buying diapers, is that going to make him present? He already said he don't want nothing to do with either of them. All right, so before she leaves the house, she's talking to her family. Mm-hmm. Does anyone go with her?
No one goes with her.
Okay. Well, take it away, Norm.
So Rhonda left the house around 2:50. Some other sources say that it was around 3:10 a.m. But again, like I mentioned before, this was about a mile up the road to his job, so it would have taken about 2 minutes for her to get there. But more than 30 minutes go by, and her family thought that it was just taking too long.
Does a mile really take 2 minutes?
I looked it up.
Locally?
If you're going 30 miles an hour?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess. If there's no red lights.
Yeah.
On the highway, a mile can definitely be 2 minutes or less.
Yeah, I mean, it said if you're going 60 miles an hour, right? It's basically like a mile a minute that you can do.
Okay. I was just curious.
So at around 3:25 a.m., Miles calls their house, as in Rhonda's house, and Rhonda's mother picks up, and he tells her that Rhonda isn't there yet, and he's asking if she left their house. So Rhonda's mom is like, well, yeah, she left quite a few minutes ago. You haven't seen her yet? And he says, no, I haven't. So Miles apparently was calling their home like every 15, 20 minutes to check in. Did Rhonda get home? So this is when Rhonda's mother calls Rochelle, who's Rhonda's oldest sister that makes an appearance on the show, to tell her that Rhonda is missing. Rochelle immediately calls Miles, and he tells her that Rhonda called him at around 3:17 a.m. to tell him that she was outside. Meaning she was outside of his job.
Okay.
He saw headlights and he started to approach what he believed was Rhonda's white van. Miles thinks that he saw someone sitting in the passenger seat, which is odd because Rhonda left the house by herself.
Right.
Unless she happened to have picked someone up along the way.
Right.
Because again, in terms of the time, was it 2:50 that she left the house or around 3:10?
Still, how would she pick up somebody? Like, right, I don't know.
Well, she called him to say she's downstairs at 3:17. If she left the house at 2:50,
like, what was she doing during that time? Yeah, okay.
And according to the Court of Appeals document, Rhonda was dating a longtime friend at the time.
Oh.
So it's a possibility maybe she stopped along the way and that's who he saw in the car.
Yeah.
As Miles walked toward the van, it started to back up and it just drove off. So he's standing there with the diaper money, just wondering what the hell. He immediately calls Rhonda. She's not answering. He's texting her. There's no response. He called her 84 times.
84 times?
Mm-hmm. The morning of May 26, 2013, Rochelle, Rhonda's oldest sister, tells her mother to call 911 and, if possible, report Rhonda as missing. Generally, you have to wait about 24 hours to report a person as missing. Their mother is able to tell investigators, you know, this is not at all like Rhonda. This is out of character for her. She's a devoted mom. She doesn't just up and leave and not come back or not tell anyone where she's going. So they actually listen to her and they dispatch officers immediately to question the family.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So this is under the 24 hours, right? It's just early morning of May 26, 2013. And apparently, Rhonda also had plans with her 12-year-old son to go to the park that day to just spend the day together and go for a jog.
Mm.
Meanwhile, Rochelle, the oldest sister, launches her own investigation. So Rochelle's actually 800 miles away in Birmingham, Alabama. Rochelle directs her sister, Robin, to keep calling Rhonda. And Robin had been driving around town since 6 a.m. looking for Rhonda, but there was no sign of her. She continues to call Rhonda's phone. Someone finally picks up. It turns out to be a man who claims that he found this phone in an alleyway.
Oh.
He said that the phone was in pieces, but he put it back together and he redialed the last number that contacted Rhonda's phone and a male answered. So this is what this man is telling Robin, Rhonda's sister. So Rochelle and Robin are thinking, well, maybe he called back Miles because Miles had called 84 times. But sometime during speaking with Robin, the homeless man apparently makes a deal to give the phone back to Miles in exchange for beer money.
Huh?
And so he's telling this to Robin that he's already contacted Miles.
So that is the man that he was talking to, where he's like, oh, I redialed the number and a man answered?
Yeah.
It was Miles?
Yes.
Okay.
And how they figured out that it is Miles is because Rochelle thinks it's very odd, and so she calls Miles, and she's like, do you know anything about speaking to a man who answered Rhonda's phone? And he said, yeah, that was me. I agreed to pick up the phone. I actually have it right now.
Okay, so I guess
by the time Rochelle gets in touch with Miles, he already has a phone.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So she's livid. She's thinking, why didn't you call 911? Why would you just take the phone from this random man that you don't know?
Yeah, and it could be evidence.
Exactly.
That man could have had something to do with her disappearance. Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what she was saying. And she said, for all you know, he could have hurt you. You don't even know, like, how do you know to trust this person?
Right. Not for nothing when she said the phone was in pieces, like, well, when he said the phone was in pieces and he put it back together.
Mm-hmm.
That's super nostalgic because back in the day, your phone, you know, you take out the battery and, like, you could put it back together.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
That is true. I wonder what kind of phone it was, but they didn't go into those details.
Mm. Maybe a BlackBerry.
Maybe.
Were people still using BlackBerries?
Maybe. In 2013?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. So this really begs a question of whether Miles was trying to hide something.
Right.
Is he somehow involved in Rhonda's disappearance?
Right.
And trying to basically cover his tracks. But at the same time, why would Miles just confess that, yeah, I actually picked up the phone from this random guy.
Right.
If he was involved, why would he be so quick to say that?
Mm. Mm-hmm.
There's just so many questions. So after she gets off the phone with Miles, Rochelle calls the police immediately and she tells them about Rhonda's phone. Well, it turns out that the police also have news for Rochelle.
Okay.
They tell her that a 13-year-old boy had just called. He was fishing at Terry Lake, which is in Pontiac, Michigan. It's a small lake that is commonly used for fishing. This teenager's hook got caught on something and he was trying to figure out what is it stuck to. And when he goes to look where the line was stuck to, he notices that there's a body floating in the lake. And to be clear, the show does not say that the line was caught on a body, but instead that the boy threw his fishing line and that it got caught onto something.
This is making me nervous. Okay, so when did this happen?
This was around 9 a.m. that Sunday morning, and Rhonda had been missing since 3 a.m. that morning.
Yeah, I know this must have been scary for the teenager, but I can't help but think about the person whose body it is floating in the lake and how horrifying it was for them.
Right.
And for their loved ones, too. These type of stories are tough ones to tell.
But I think that we can all agree that it's even tougher to live through them. Now let's turn to what detectives found. Detectives are called to the scene where they find the body of a black female. They find the body floating face up and she is basically naked. She has on a sports bra, and it has been pulled over her breast.
Wait, this is worse than I thought, and I didn't think it could get any worse. So her body's just out there, naked, for everyone to see.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much.
What kind of state was her body in? Like, did she have cuts?
There appeared to be, like, abrasions on her arms. There definitely was indication of trauma from her forehead to her neck. On the show, it said that this black female was surrounded by grocery items. They didn't go into details as to what those items were. They also found a child's drawing. They end up going to Rhonda's house because apparently the drawing had the name of one of her sons on it. So they have reason to believe that this might be her. Based on one of the articles, the police showed Rhonda's mother a picture of this individual with their eyes closed, and she's able to make a positive ID, but her reaction was more so along the lines of, oh good, you found her. What hospital is she in? She had no idea that she was deceased from the picture.
Dang.
And so detectives had to break the news to her that Rhonda had actually passed.
Oh my gosh.
So this was just very shocking to the family. Terry Lake was apparently just a few blocks away from where they lived. Robin, one of Rhonda's sisters, is the one to break the news to Rochelle that unfortunately Rhonda had passed away. Rochelle actually had somewhat of a premonition that Rhonda had passed. As soon as the mom had told her, like, Rhonda's missing, she just got this strange feeling that Rhonda was strangled and that she was in a lake. And she told this to her family immediately, as soon as she felt the sensation. So when Robin was telling her this news, Robin said to her, hey, you're not going to believe it, but your premonition came true.
Oh.
Like, she was found strangled and in a lake.
Oof.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Did she get this premonition while she's, like, just, you know, when she hears it on the phone, I guess? Or does she go to sleep and she dreams it?
After her conversation with her mom, she just felt it.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
So did they go and search the lake when she kind of told her family this premonition? You know what I mean? Like, when the kid finds Rhonda's body, it's the next day, right?
So it is that day, like later on in that day of May 26th.
Right, that's true, because she left early in the wee hours.
Yeah.
Okay, but did Rochelle say to her parents or whoever, hey, we should search lakes?
I don't know that she told investigators that because, you know, there's not enough evidence there that would point them to a lake.
That's fascinating.
You know, but
in all the cases we've done so far, I think this is episode 97, we've only had one other case that had any sort of, like, premonition, psychic stuff. Yeah.
Is it the case from Philadelphia?
Yes. Yeah, that was the Shelley Turner case that we did earlier on. That was a wild one, too. But wow, this premonition.
Yeah. Huh. So, Rochelle is obviously distraught, as you can imagine, but she does tell officers to look into Miles, okay. Rhonda's ex-boyfriend. Miles is brought in for questioning, and he appears to be genuinely upset, and he wants who did this to Rhonda to be found. He tells him the same story that he told Rhonda's family, that she came to pick up money for the diapers. Rhonda called him when she was downstairs, and he said that he was on the third floor of the building, so it would take him about 2 to 3 minutes to come downstairs. And by the time he got downstairs, he saw headlights to her car. She immediately started to back away, and she just drove off.
Right, right.
He told them that he saw someone in her car in the passenger seat, but he couldn't identify who that person was. So Miles ends up calling Rhonda, and obviously he called her several times because he called her 84 times. And finally, a male answers. So the homeless guy that found Rhonda's smashed phone is a person who answered, and he claims to not know anything about Rhonda, but he just found this phone and he put it together. Investigators find his story to be odd, and they were skeptical about it, but they don't have any additional evidence to hold him at the time, so they just let Miles leave.
They didn't find it weird that a homeless man had found it? I'm confused. You said that they're, like, kind of side-eyeing Miles' story?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the chances of her showing up and then someone else already being in the car and then driving off.
Within 2 minutes, yeah, 2-3 minutes I'm sure, of talking. Yeah. Which is very odd.
I can see why they're like, hmm.
So detectives try to piece together the story that Miles told them. So they start by going to the location where the phone was found. They were able to find this homeless guy and speak with him about finding Rhonda's phone. And he shows them exactly where he found it.
Right.
He corroborates what Miles told them about the phone and how he put it together and how he and Miles spoke on the phone and Miles retrieved the phone from him. The second thing that they did was go to Miles' job. He worked in a Chase building in Pontiac, Michigan, and they were able to pull surveillance, and they saw that he was, in fact, in the building early in the morning at around 3 a.m., and he hadn't left the building. And they were also trying to look for Rhonda's white van because they hadn't found it. They were having difficulty locating it, but in an article that I read, it stated that detectives found Rhonda's van a block away from Terry Lake. So I don't really understand how they had difficulties finding the van.
Right. Well, here's the thing. Did the van appear there after they had found her body?
That's what I was wondering. According to the same article, the people who lived nearby told police that it was parked in the area around 10 p.m. Saturday night.
Right. Oh, and so they saw the van parked there at 10 p.m. That doesn't even make sense.
So it doesn't make sense unless, you know, maybe the facts here are off a little bit and maybe the van was parked there Sunday night. I think that would make more sense.
At 10 p.m.
After the fact.
Yeah. I'm trying to give the police some credit here. Yeah. Because I just would think that they would search within a one block radius.
Yeah.
So at least.
Yeah. So that just doesn't make any sense.
If anything, I feel like maybe it was placed there after they had searched and cleared it. Right. Mm-hmm.
So in the meantime, the autopsy report comes back and it showed that Rhonda was strangled to death. Mm. It also showed that she unfortunately was raped. So they did find semen inside of her, and they collected that sample.
Oof.
As this is all unfolding, the news outlet eventually caught wind of Rhonda's case, and they wanted to speak with the family. So they do go to Rhonda's house, and they knock on the door, and the mother just didn't have it in her to speak to anyone. As you can imagine, she was just emotionally distraught. Rochelle volunteered to basically be the voice for the family and speaking up about Rhonda's story. And the way that she put it is, we have to tell Rhonda's story. So Rochelle, who's the oldest sister, like I mentioned before, she had a degree in broadcast journalism, and she was able to use her background to raise awareness about Rhonda's case. So she knew what key points she wanted to get out about Rhonda's character, how she was a devoted mother of three, what her daily routine was like, and what she meant to her family. Her hope was that if she can humanize Rhonda as much as possible, that someone somewhere might know something and come forward. Rochelle also used Facebook and Twitter to get this information out. She just wanted Rhonda's story to not be forgotten, and of course, to find the monster who murdered Rhonda. Rochelle was also fortunate to have a major media connection through her friendship with Star Jones. So, for those who don't know, Star Jones is a popular attorney, journalist, television personality. She's probably most known for her co-hosting The View for 9 seasons. So this was like in the late 90s, early 2000s. And the way that her and Rochelle connected is they connected online, and they also found out that they were both part of AKA sorority.
Okay.
So they were able to bond on that too. And I think just like both of their backgrounds in journalism as well.
I didn't know she was a lawyer.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Star Jones. I didn't know.
Star Jones was actually the one that reached out to Rochelle, and she offered to use her platform to get the story out. Okay. She wanted to help Rochelle and her family in any way that she could. And she wanted Rhonda's story to get as much coverage as possible. So before you knew it, Rochelle was being called for interviews about her sister's case. So this is all happening just days after Rhonda's murder. So she gets an interview with Roland Martin, who is an American journalist, and he's affiliated with CNN. He also appeared on a variety of shows, including The Situation Room and Anderson Cooper's AC360. And he wrote a ton of books as well.
On what?
Damn, Priscilla.
Well, damn. I'm Norma. Who is this man? Is he like...
Okay.
You should leave that part in, because that's kind of funny.
He wrote books such as Speak, Brother, A Black Man's View of America.
Okay.
Listening to the Spirit Within, 50 Perspectives on Faith, the first President Barack Obama's Road to the White House, as originally reported by Roland Martin. So books like that.
Okay, so he's a black man.
He is.
Who is civil rights and religious.
Yeah.
He's all about civil rights and religion. That's what I get.
I mean, he's done a lot. He has a Wikipedia page, so.
Okay.
Rochelle also landed an interview with Nancy Grace, who, like Star Jones, is also a television journalist and an attorney. So she's getting a lot of coverage. Which is interesting because I had never heard of this case.
Me neither.
And this was 2013, so.
Yeah. Remember when Nancy Grace was interviewing a father on TV about his son being missing? He was black, okay? And his son was missing, and he was, like, just pleading for people to return his son. And she's, like, literally, it's live on air, and she's like, wait, we're getting word that your son has been found in the basement of your home, sir? And he's just like, what? Oh, my God. I'm going to pass out. Look up the clip because it's, like, ridiculous. And she's just like, sir, you're saying you have no idea how your son got in your basement? And he's like, oh, my gosh, I'm going to pass out. But it turns out that he was the one keeping his son.
Yeah, I kind of remember that.
If you're looking to have a little laughter, go ahead and search that up.
So just, like, imagine the type of coverage that this case is having, even though we haven't heard about it.
Right.
The detectives feel even more obligated to solve this case, right? Because it's really being highlighted in a way that I don't think any of their cases were really highlighted before.
I think we need to, like, put the spotlight on a lot of cases then, because if that's what makes detectives want to do their jobs, like, what about your paycheck? What about just doing justice?
Yeah.
Right, like getting justice, I mean.
And lucky for them, a call did come in about the white van. And I know that I mentioned the van earlier, but this is exactly the point when the van was actually found. The caller basically mentioned that they spotted this white van. It seemed out of place, and they just had a feeling that something wasn't right. When detectives get there, they are able to identify the VIN number on the white van, and it matches the one registered to Rhonda. They also found Kid's drawing in the van, and it had one of Rhonda's children's name on it. From what they observed inside the van, there appeared to be a struggle in the back seat. Detectives described a terrible smell and markings on the seat that aligned with someone defecating on it.
Oh no.
So they basically believe that Rhonda was raped and strangled in the van. On the ground near the minivan, they found a prescription bottle with the name Jamal Carson, and they believe that there may be a connection to this Jamal Carson and Rhonda. So as far as suspects, it looks like Jamal Carson is a new suspect, but what about the homeless guy that found Rhonda's phone and Miles, Rhonda's ex? So detectives don't go into details about the homeless man, but it's likely they found evidence that showed that he was not involved. Detectives also find that Miles' alibi checks out. They don't go into details as to whether they compared his DNA sample to the semen sample that was extracted from Rhonda's body. But basically, although Miles was an absentee father, he was not involved in Rhonda's murder, and he was actually cleared. So by now, 5 days have gone by. So all the media coverage and interviews, the finding of the van and the pill bottle, it's only been a matter of 5 days. On June 1st, 2013, a funeral service is held for Rhonda. Her family are determined now more than ever to find her killer, who's still on the loose. And Rochelle especially took it upon herself to make sure that she was dotting her I's and crossing her T's. She literally would carry a notebook with her all the time and would just take down notes from people in the neighborhood, and also writing down things that people would post online on the Facebook page or through Twitter.
Wow.
So she was always stopping by the police department to share this information. She was really on them about getting this case solved by any means necessary. And funny enough, Rochelle realized that the name on the prescription bottle matched the nephew of one of her friends who had the same name, Jamal Carson.
Oh.
So she's wondering, wait a second, is it my friend's nephew, Jamal Carson? So detectives find her friend's nephew, Jamal Carson, and they question him because maybe this is the person on the bottle. So Jamal comes in for questioning and he denies involvement in Rhonda's murder. Instead, Jamal goes on to tell an interesting story about how his night went. Well, the night of May 25th into the morning of May 26th, 2013.
Oh, well, here we go. Oh, gosh. Okay.
So he tells detectives that he was hanging out at a bus stop downtown and he met up with a guy that goes by the name of B. And apparently B wanted to have a little bit of fun that night and asked Jamal if he knew of any prostitutes in the area. And Jamal happened to know of a prostitute by the name of Mandy. So they find Mandy and now they plan to basically all have fun together. Except Jamal wanted to watch them. That was a plan.
Here we go. Okay.
So they go back to Jamal's house and things immediately went left because B was being super aggressive towards Mandy. And Mandy changed her mind. She was no longer comfortable with the situation. So she leaves and then B leaves, apparently. So at this point, detectives ask Jamal about the prescription bottle.
Wait, before we get there, he didn't know B? Or was B his friend?
the way that they made it seem was as though they were acquaintances.
Okay, because I'm like, you bring in people that you don't really know to your house? Like, what happened to hello? How are you?
I'm pretty sure they were acquaintances.
Okay.
Because I'm like, well, and he definitely knew of Mandy.
Okay.
As well. So when he's asked about the prescription bottle, he does confirm that those are his pills. I don't know what the pills were. They never confirmed. But he basically tells them it's likely that either B or Mandy took the pills with them when they left.
Okay.
He's even willing to take a lie detector test, which he does, and he passes with flying colors. But detectives are still not buying this. They think it's just a little too convenient that this was how Jamal's night went and that the prescription bottle was taken out of his house and somehow is found by Rhonda's minivan.
I mean, we've seen stranger things be true.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? Like, in all these episodes, we've seen interesting things. I mean, look just now in this episode, right? Miles saying that, hey, I approached the car and she drove off.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like,
definitely. That's like what? And even the homeless guy
right.
finding a crushed phone and putting it back together.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just bizarre. Rochelle finds this out and she tells detectives that although Jamal's name is on the prescription bottle, that she's familiar with him enough that she doesn't believe that he's involved. She doesn't think that he's the kind of person to do something like this. And that he wouldn't hurt her sister, Rhonda.
See, I need to know what was in that prescription bottle then. Because, like, if we really think about it, and it's something that, like, you can sell on the street, whether it's Adderall, you know, some type of oxycodone. Mm-hmm. Is that how you say it? Oxycodone? Mm-hmm. Oxy. You know, people be selling stuff.
Sure.
So, did Jamal, like, sell it to B? Or sell it to someone and just give it to them in the bottle?
You know what? You never know. And maybe those details were discussed, but they did not put it on the show.
Hmm.
Or in any articles that I saw.
Well, just a thought.
Mm-hmm. So now detectives have to find B and Mandy. And it doesn't take long for them to find Mandy because she'd just be out and about, you know, on the streets. And she's also described as being quite the character. So, the day of the murder, Mandy does have an alibi. She was highly intoxicated and she went to the hospital. She is caught on hospital surveillance and she's also on record as a treated patient that day. As for B, it was harder to locate him. They try to find the person who was driving the bus on the night in question because, yes, all three of them ended up taking the bus. Remember I said that Jamal was at downtown waiting for a bus.
Mm-hmm. That must have been an interesting bus ride.
Exactly. So that's why the bus driver actually remembered the bus ride.
I was going to say, like, that is something that you would remember if you were, okay.
So they were able to get in contact with the driver, and that's exactly what she said, that they were quite rowdy. And she does remember B, especially because he was very flirty towards her. So much so that he actually gave her his phone number.
Oh, here we go.
So detectives direct her to text B and ask for a photo. And he falls for it. He does, in fact, send her a photo of himself.
Oh, whew, I thought you were going to say a photo of his like an unsolicited, you know. Listen, well, they just be sending photos of themselves. And I'm like, why? This is disturbing.
But yeah, I mean, you never know. But detectives now have his phone number and a photo, and they are able to trace the number back to Bobby Lee Taylor.
Can I just say right now, like, I'm sure everyone else listening to this is thinking the same, like, where is this going? Because right? I'm not, so like, wait a minute. I was on one path in the beginning, and I feel like I have whiplash because every 5 minutes you're giving me new information and I'm just like, wait, what? So that's just what I want to say.
Yeah, that's how I felt when I was doing this episode. I had no idea. I had to just keep, like, adding names to my notes. Like, right. Okay, suspect. Okay, this is clear. And then I'm like, there's more people?
Holy moly.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, don't keep us waiting. Come on.
Yeah, so detectives trace the phone activity from Bobby Lee Taylor, and they noticed that he was always on his phone, morning and night. But
on the 2013?
Yes.
Okay.
They said literally all hours of the day, morning into night.
You couldn't really do much in 2013. I mean, I guess. Okay.
I think they meant, like, he was on the phone, like, making phone calls all the time. Like, for hours.
That's even weirder.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if he wasn't on the phone, like, talking to someone, he was texting people.
So, I can imagine them peering through, like, just, like, going through his phone records.
Yeah.
Might need a few people.
Mm-hmm. But they did notice that on the early morning of May 26, 2013, the morning that Rhonda disappeared, there was no phone activity on Bobby's phone between 3 a.m. and 7 a.m. So that was immediately suspicious to them.
Yeah. What's going on, Bobby?
They are able to track down Bobby. He had some sort of traffic ticket and possibly a warrant out for his arrest. So that's how they were able to bring him in for questioning. At the time, Bobby was 42 years old. And just to do a quick background on Bobby, he had numerous prior convictions, such as possessing stolen property, aggravated assault. He escaped from prison?
Excuse me?
Sorry, I'm just...
Is Bobby a crackhead?
You know what?
I'm just saying, crackheads be... Listen, they could do it all. There's nothing they can't do.
You never
I'm
know.
Saying, like... Mm-hmm. I'm saying it as if I hung out with crackheads as a kid, but it's like... I heard, what's his name say something? Little Boosie? I forgot what he said in that video about crackheads, but he was just like... You know, crackheads.
Oh, I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
But they'd be like, they could beat the fastest person, like someone who has trained in track and field. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, Bobby just seems like an interesting character right now. He's 42. You're 42 and you were about to have you some fun with with Mandy, Miss Personality over here. How old is Jamal? How the heck are they all hanging out together? I got questions. I know y'all are like, shut up. So I'm gonna shut up. But, yeah. Those are my inner thoughts.
Okay. I think everyone has the same questions, though. For real. He also had entered a home and attempted to sexually assault a woman that was sleeping. And she was able to fight him off. That's just a little bit of his criminal background. In May of 2012, he was actually released from prison and was on parole at the time of Rhonda's murder. So, is it possible that he added murderer to that list of convictions?
I mean, shit. Sexual assault is on there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. Is he capable of that? Bobby escaped from prison. You gotta have a death wish to do that. You know what I'm saying?
Shit. Mm-hmm.
You know? Like, that is next level.
Yeah, for real. So detectives go on to ask him about Rhonda and what he was doing Memorial Day weekend. And he basically told them that he went downtown for a good time, but that never happened. It was short-lived. So he goes through the details of how he met up with Mandy and Jamal.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Then they ask him about the pill bottle that was missing from Jamal's house. And he didn't have an answer for that. When they asked him about 3 a.m. and onward in terms of where he was, that's when he invoked his right to remain silent.
Ooh. Oh. Okay.
So it's not his first rodeo.
Right.
Meaning like he knows when to invoke his right to remain silent.
Whoa, okay.
Mm-hmm. But they just feel like this could be their guy. They get a sample of his DNA, but it will take 2 weeks for results to come back. but results come in eventually. There is a match. Bobby Lee Taylor was matched in terms of his semen was found inside of Rhonda's vagina.
Oh my gosh.
So this is now 25 days after Rhonda's murder. And on June 20th, 2013, he is officially charged with her murder.
Okay. Wow.
Are you surprised?
Yeah, I thought you were going to throw us for a loop there and be like, his DNA matched someone else's on the system. You know, like.
Okay.
Bobby?
Yeah.
Really? I mean, once he honestly invoked his rights, not saying it's a sign of guilt, but it's like the fact that he invoked it for that particular question, but was fine answering to his other crimes of soliciting a prostitute and, you know what I'm saying?
Right, yeah.
Maybe he realized, like, oh, I won't get that much time for admitting to that.
Okay.
And as he's getting closer, he's like, nah, I'm not saying anything else.
Yeah.
I'm shocked. I need to, like, I'm just, okay. How does Rhonda know Bobby? How do they end up in the same car together?
So let me go through the details of the trial a little bit.
Okay.
The trial happens, I think, like 6 months later, December 2nd, 2013. Isn't that really fast for a murder trial?
Yep.
So the prosecution believes that Rhonda's van was unlocked. So when she had called Miles at around 3:17 a.m., her car was unlocked. So literally between that time, the 2-3 minutes, this random dude, Bobby Taylor, jumped into her car and likely had her at gunpoint.
No.
Yeah.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Like just random, a random attack.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
But do you see like 6 degrees of separation because of the fact that like he's connected to James, who's connected to Rochelle's friend?
Who's James? You mean Jamal?
Jamal, sorry. Yeah. My bad, Jamal.
I know. I was like, oh my gosh, is there another suspect?
Oh God. All the names. I'm just like, okay. That is just
random attack.
Whoa. What?
Yeah.
But like, oh, wait a minute. When you get in the car and you start driving, your car usually automatically locks. Well, let me know in the comments if y'all disagree. Like, if you have a car that is from 2013 or earlier, does your car automatically lock while it's driving?
It looked like the van was like a white Chrysler van. Probably like an older model, like, but maybe like still 2000s. It reminded me of mom's like 2002, 2003 Chrysler van. But I still think that
maybe it doesn't lock.
Did that not lock?
I mean, listen, I'm used to hitting the lock button either way when I get in my car.
Yeah, I do that too.
Even though my car locks but I mean, we're in 2024 now, so now cars might do that on their own. It locks when I drive, but like that's the first thing I do when I get in the car.
Yeah, same.
I'm surprised, Norma. You miss like leave the door open, like unlocked, me not walking in the dang dark. Not your car. No, I don't want anyone breaking into my car, but I'm going to walk outside in the dark.
And leave my front door unlocked. Yeah, it doesn't make sense. Norma. I don't do that anymore, guys. That was risky behavior.
Phew, thank goodness.
But yeah, this was, according to them, a random attack. He instructed her to drive away,
likely
at gunpoint. At some point, he threw the phone out the window and it landed in that alleyway.
Whoa.
And broke into pieces, right? Well, broke apart enough for it to be put back together by this homeless man. Then he apparently attacked her at some point, raped her, strangled her, dumped her body in the Terry Lake, and dropped the van somewhere else.
This is just insane.
And then he walked over to his girlfriend's house after dropping the van off.
Excuse me?
Took a shower and acted like nothing happened.
Wait a minute. In like just a few hours, he tries to hang out with Miss Personality and Jamal, who I call James. So he tries to hang out with them and get it on.
Yeah.
He leaves there. He runs into Rhonda. He kidnaps her. rapes her and murders her, dumps her body and the car, and goes home to his girlfriend.
Yeah.
There's a human out there who voluntarily was dating him.
I don't know to what extent.
I guess love is blind.
Maybe. Who even knows? Like,
honestly,
they may not have. She may have not even had known about his.
Because we hear about history. That all the time when you hear about these serial killers who get killed. Like, not killed. I mean, hey, is that called a Freudian slip? That serial killer should be killed. But you hear about the serial killers and their kids, and their kids saying, there's no way my dad did this. Like, he was the best dad. You know?
People live double lives. It's crazy to think about.
I mean, wait a minute. And then Bobby gave his number to the bus driver? What, what the hell? He a trifling, murderous ninja. That's what he is.
Yeah, I agree. So, on June 11th, 2013, he is found guilty of first-degree murder and criminal sexual conduct. At his sentencing hearing, her family, Rhonda's family, basically said to give him the maximum. And the judge did that. He was sentenced to 75 to 120 years in prison for first-degree murder.
Oh, he ain't never getting out.
Yeah, he's not. As to how Rhonda's family feels about all of this, I think the overall sentiment is that there's no closure to murder.
Right.
As her sister Rochelle put it, you can't let the murder of a loved one consume you. You have to forgive yourself and not think about what you could have done differently or should have done differently. Mm. At least that's how she feels now. She said at the time that it was very hard for her because she is the oldest sister and she had always protected her siblings. Oof. So that was really tough for her. Rhonda's death also had a major impact on her children. In one of the articles that I read, her six-year-old apparently said to Rhonda's mother, "Nana, I know that you said that my mom went to heaven to be with God, but when does she come home?"
Oh, dang.
Yeah, so, you know, justice was served, but it's just still, it doesn't bring Rhonda back.
It doesn't. You know?
And her children really, they really are missing out on having their mother in their lives.
Did it bring Miles back? Because
that's a really good question as to his relationship with the daughter.
Right.
I did not see anything on that.
See, I would like to know his sentiment on this because I'm sure he's thinking if I hadn't called her,
right,
she wouldn't have come.
Yeah.
And it's my fault.
But who would think that something like that would happen within 2-3 minutes of talking to someone?
Right. The other side of it is she was so scared she drove away. Like, see, oh man, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
Because you never know how you're going to react in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say what you would have done, should have done, but you just don't know how your body is going to, like, react, you know?
Yeah.
I would think that maybe I would drive my car into a wall or something.
Right,
Or, like, back up really fast, make him kind of fall over, and then get out of the car and run or something. But, again, that's me just like, oh, like, this is what I, you know, me thinking about it in a calm manner.
Yeah.
Where there's no threat on me. You know what I'm saying? So that isn't lost when I'm saying that. You know, like, when you're in the moment, I'm sure she just was like, maybe if I do what he says, he'll let me go.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll let me go. But you know what's also insane about this story is, like, so many people could have accidentally gone to jail, like, to prison, like, for 75 plus years.
Yeah.
Miles being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
If they had never found that pill bottle.
Yeah.
I mean, was his DNA, Bobby's DNA, in the system from the other sexual assault? Like, did they run it through CODIS?
Like, I was thinking that too. Like, oh, he has prior convictions. His DNA must be in the system. But they made it seem like right there and then they're taking a DNA sample to see if it matches the semen sample.
Yeah, because I wonder if, like, you know, that's something once they plug it into the computer.
Yeah,
it should pop up if there's a match in CODIS.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it takes a while for the match to pop up and it just will happen. They just collected his DNA to make it faster. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like, that's something I would ask a cop one day or detective if I had a chance, because it's interesting.
Yeah.
Especially for someone who has already done some sexual assault before.
Right.
Like, your DNA, I would think, is in the system already. So, yeah, the fact that, like, so many people could have gotten caught up in this, or this might have gone unsolved.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it was unsolved and it went unsolved, there would have been a lot of people, I would say mostly Miles, who would have gotten looks from the community like, oh, he did it and he's free.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like, it's just, the whole thing is bizarre. I didn't think that the story would lead us here. And it's just unfortunate that she got caught up in some random attack, you know, mm-hmm. and that Bobby felt like he needed to do that.
This is definitely very unfortunate. So there's currently a blog that, or a website that is set up in honor of Rhonda. It's called Rhonda's Rules. And basically it's a checklist for mothers on what to put in place, because Rhonda didn't have life insurance. She didn't have a will, right? So it kind of sets forth the importance of estate planning and gives those details and resources on how to do that on this website.
And we will link that in the show notes.
Yes. As far as what Bobby Lee is up to now, he did appeal the case in 2015. So Bobby Lee basically said that there was insufficient evidence to pin the murder on him, that although, sure, he sexually assaulted Rhonda, and there's evidence of that, he didn't murder her. But basically, the court ended up affirming his conviction, saying that the prosecution still proved that he was a perpetrator beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
He also claimed that there was an abuse of discretion by the prosecution in admitting certain evidence that he felt was irrelevant, and that happened to be testimony as to penis photo that he sent the bus driver, because when
he did send her one? You see?
He sent a picture of his face and his penis.
You see? My spidey senses went off. It went off.
Mm-hmm. It really did. That's so funny.
Wow. So the bus driver testified about this at trial.
Yeah. So basically the court of appeals found that that was not an abuse of discretion, and that this testimony was relevant to the case, and basically they still affirmed his conviction.
So basically he ain't getting out.
He's not getting out.
Ever. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
I wonder if the bus driver was thinking about reaching out to him.
On the show, it seemed like she was into him.
What?
Yeah. Or, like, just found him to be intriguing. I don't know, or an interesting
Is there
guy.
A picture of Bobby? Let me see a picture of Bobby.
Yeah, sure. Let me see.
Listen, the outside could look great. If your insides suck, you're an ugly person. That's how I see it, so.
This is him.
Oh, no. No. Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Mm-mm.
That's him.
Mm-hmm. It's a no.
But maybe it was,
I'm
like,
sure
his
he was
personality.
Charismatic. Yeah.
Yes, I think that's what it was. And she's just like, okay, fine, you can give me your number.
Listen, people like Bobby wear many hats and faces, basically. Right? Like... Mm-hmm. Who knows? Like, I don't... The fact that he even murdered her, it's, like, not even part of his MO. He just kept escalating, though.
Yeah,
to, like,
exactly.
The next thing and the next thing and the next thing.
Yeah, it was
and
bound to happen.
Honestly, the chances of someone else coming by and murdering her after he raped her, like, what are the chances of that happening?
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
It just doesn't make any sense. And again, the probability of that is just damn near impossible.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, is the story of Rosalind, aka Rhonda Ramson. Aww.
That's really sad.
Yeah.
That's really, really sad. This was not what I was expecting at all.
Yeah, it was a lot more complex than I was expecting to.
Yeah. Well, Bobby, he got a lot of time to think about the stuff that he's done.
Yeah, he definitely does.
Might be able to escape prison, but you can't escape the nightmare that you're about to have right now, like every night.
That's basically what her sister Rochelle said, like, okay, you're in prison, maybe it isn't clicking for you now, but it will click for you when you meet
your maker. What's not clicking?
Your judgment will come when you have to meet God.
Yeah.
You have to answer to him.
It'll hit him eventually. Has Rochelle taken up any type of true crime type of journalism?
I wouldn't say she has taken up that kind of journalism, but she definitely puts it out there that if you have a loved one, to basically be their voice. She's very...
Yeah.
I don't even know the word that I'm trying to think
vigilant?
Of. Vigilant? Yes. She's very vigilant when it comes to that. That you have to be the voice for your loved one.
You do, because if not, who's going to speak up for them?
Yeah, like, who's going to tell their story better than what you can do, right? Sometimes the news can flip things around, or there could be misinformation, and your loved one would want their story to be told by a family member, if anything.
So that someone is that told knows the right them. Way.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a sad and tragic story.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
I don't know. The takeaway from this is just that there are crazy people in the world, and don't go out ever. Honestly, like, I'm paranoid now. It's just gosh.
Well, definitely lock your car doors. Yep. But again, who's to say that I was also thinking maybe it was locked and she unlocked it because she knew that Miles was coming downstairs.
True.
Within 2 minutes.
Right. Or maybe she thought it was Miles approaching the car. Maybe she couldn't really see. It's dark.
Oh, I never thought about that.
That's so sad.
Yeah. But that's this week's case. Tune in 2 Tuesdays from today for the next episode of It's a Mystery for Me.
That's April 2nd. And guess what? Norma's birthday is April 3rd.
Yeah, so I'm not hosting.
You're not hosting the next one.
No.
Don't worry, I gotcha. I want to be the hostess with the mostess. All right, y'all. Stay safe out there.
Bye, guys.